The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
And so what we're working on right now is the very odd introduction to the most central experience of Judaism, which is the giving of the Torah at Sinai. What is that odd introduction? It's this idolater, Moses' father-in-law, Yitro. And we were learning and we'd be working on the meaning of, and Yitro heard all that God had done to Moses and his people, all that Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei had taken them out from Egypt. And we'd be working on the meaning of that and how it fits into the context as a preparation towards the giving of Torah at Sinai. So today, I want to bring to you some pieces from the Zohar that responds to that whole issue. And as I mentioned to you, the Midrash, the oral tradition, is written as a kind of running commentary to the verses. Now the Zohar is also written in that format. But the truth is that the Zohar goes off in many, many more tangents. Okay? And when we really need to read very carefully whether this is not a tangent, whether in some mysterious way, you know, this is relating to the Parsha, or whether there's just something that was said that stimulated a tangent, but it's not so much integrally connected to the idea, that would be a learning in and of its own. What I've done here is I basically selected pieces from the Zohar from this portion called Yitro, which I thought were appropriate in terms of simply understanding the story. None of the tangents. But there is one piece in here that is somewhat of a tangent, but I thought it was a very important tangent and one that kind of brings things together. So let's look at the beginning of the Zohar, or what I brought. Now, I kind of come into the middle of a passage in the Zohar, but I didn't want to go through the whole stuff before it. But now, when this king and this priest of the other side are subdued and their power broken, all the other sides follow suit and are also subdued and broken and acknowledge the sovereignty of the Holy One, and in this way He alone rules above and below. Now, before we even get any further, and hopefully you've already at least read this one, who's the king and the priest of the other side that they're referring to? What's the king? Yes.
Pharaoh.
Pharaoh is the king, the priest is Yitro. Alright, now what's the other side? Now, according to Judaism, we believe that God is one. Absolutely one. Alright? And that really there's nothing but God. Now that doesn't mean that you and I are God, but that really we exist within God. In other words, the metaphor is, just as I am to God like the thought is to the thinker. If you at this very moment picture a human being, don't even picture, I want you to create in your mind a new human being. Alright? Where does that human being exist? Within your mind. Okay? Is that human being you? No. Are you that human being? No. But would it be correct now to say there's you and this human being? Not really, because this human being is so completely dependent upon you, but really there's still just you. And this human being in your mind is an aspect of yourself, although other than yourself. Alright? That's a difficult concept, and I've got classes on that, which is not what I'm doing right now. But I have to tell you that in order to understand the meaning of the other side. The other side is there's an illusion according to Judaism. The only thing that's real is oneness. Right? Anything that suggests separateness, right? Separateness is an illusion. Alright? Is an illusion. We're 25 people in the room. And there's a feeling that there's me, there's you, there's you, there's him, there's she, right? And there's a feeling that there are 25 separate people in this room. But according to Judaism, that's an illusion. An illusion that our bodies give off. Because the truth is that we're all really one. We're not one and the same. For that reason, we have a Jewish law that says that you cannot count people. Right? You're not allowed to count a person. Why? Because which one is number one? We're also interconnected. It's like if you've ever seen some of these Escher pictures where you have various figures that are interfaced with each other. If I take one picture, one figure out of the picture, all the other figures melt. Because if you remember the one with the bird and the fish, and the bird is outlining the fish, and the fish is outlining the bird, well, each one seems to experience itself as a separate reality. But if I were to take the fish away, then the bird would melt away, and of course if the bird would melt away, the fish next to it would melt away, everything would disappear. Although they all seem like separate figures, the truth is that although they are other, they are one. The other side is an illusion that there is separateness, that there are separate domains. There's the other side. Alright? So now that is the king and the priest of the other side. The king and the priest of the other side base their life and promote a position of separateness, multiplicity, in contrast to oneness and unity. Alright? You got that as an introduction here? Alright?
Can you repeat that?
Say it again. Okay, I'll say it again. The king and the priest of the other side, in Hebrew it's called the Sitra Acher. The Sitra Acher is the forces of evil. The Sitra Acher. That's what it's referred to.
Put it on the board here for you. You have to know me. Right? Sitra Acher is the Aramaic term for the evil forces in the universe. What is the foundation of the evil forces in the universe? The evil forces in the universe play upon multiplicity and separateness. Right? That's what they promote. They promote an illusion. There's no such thing as separateness. There is only multiplicity in oneness, and oneness in multiplicity. But there is no separateness. Right? We all there? Okay. So there's something called the priest and king of the other side. Now, what does a priest represent in contrast to a king? A king is what? State. And a priest is religion. So you have religion and state represented over here. And it's the king which promotes separateness, right, in the realm of statehood. And the priest promotes separateness in the realm of religion. And these are the two realms. Now let's read on a little bit. Before the sovereignty of the Holy One will be acknowledged, something has to happen. These two powers of the other side have to be subdued and broken and acknowledge the sovereignty of the Holy One. In this way, He alone rules above and below. As it is written, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Everyone with us? Just where the brackets are that says Isaiah. ISA. In just the same way, God broke here on earth the power of an old foolish king, namely Pharaoh. And when Moses said to him, the God of the Hebrews had met with us, replied, I do not know the Lord. Alright, that's what happened. When Moses first came to Pharaoh, he said, God sent me, he says, I don't know who this Lord is. Right? Of course, what ultimately happens is Pharaoh acknowledges God. Let's go on. But when the Holy One, desiring that His name should be glorified on earth as it is in heaven, punished him and his people, he came and acknowledged the Holy One. Right? He acknowledged the Holy One. In fact, that acknowledgement is spelt out in the next piece of Zohar. So let's go to that next piece of Zohar for a second. Right down after it. Verses 2:12. Let all the people praise thee. Signifies that when the heathen nations acknowledge the Holy One, his glory is consummated above and below. When Pharaoh acknowledged him by saying, the Lord is righteous. Pharaoh initially said, I don't know who this God is. But later on, he said, the Lord is righteous. Let's go back to our Zohar. But when the Holy One, desiring that his name should be glorified on earth as it is in heaven, punished him and his people, he came and acknowledged the Holy One. Subsequently, his peace also, namely Jethro, the priest of On, idolatry, was also humbled, so that he came and acknowledged the Holy One, saying, Blessed be He, the Lord, who has delivered you. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. So therefore, the Zohar demonstrates something very fascinating. What is this Zohar accomplishing for us? Before we even know exactly its point, we already get a sense of its direction.
What is it doing that until now no midrash has done for us? It gives us a thematic appreciation of how the Torah is developing. The giving of Torah at Sinai happened when it happened because two essential powers needed to be subdued prior to that. Do you follow? What were those two powers that had to be subdued? The king and the priest of idolatry. Okay? And when that was put in place, the stage was set for the revelation at Sinai. What is the revelation of Sinai? The revelation of the sovereignty of the Holy One. Alright? Now that's a fantastic Zohar, because all of a sudden these are not just simply interesting stories. But the Zohar puts the story in a context of a spiritual evolution, a certain evolution of consciousness. Before we could get to Sinai, something had to happen in the world. Right? What had to happen in the world? The priest and the king of idolatry, the priest and the king of the other side, which we still need to develop, needed to be subdued. And once that happens, we can get the Torah. Now this is very important to us, because we can then start asking ourselves, well, so what does it really take to get the Torah? What needs to be put in place before we're ready to hear the Torah? Alright? All of a sudden the Zohar took these various stories and said, they're not various stories. They're one thematic development graduating and building up towards the revelation of God at Sinai. Alright? And all of a sudden we recognize from the Zohar that it's important that these nations, right, are ready for the giving of Torah at Sinai. But they didn't get the Torah at Sinai. We got the Torah at Sinai. No, they had to be ready too. And that starts giving us a little more food for thought of what's the significance of the giving of Torah at Sinai. Right? Because very often one looks at it as a very particularistic event. Something that happened to the Jews, for the Jews, because of the Jews. And now the Torah tells us no. It brings in a whole other appreciation of the whole story. Are you following this? Are we together? Okay. So let's understand this a little more. Let's read on. It says, so when the king and the priest, this is the last four lines of that first Zohar, so when the king and that priest acknowledged the Holy One, blessed be He, and were humbled before Him, He was exalted above and below. And then only, and I would underline, and that's what I did in my notes, underline the then, and then only did He give forth the Torah as undisputed sovereign over all. There had to be a period in time where the whole world consciousness was ready to receive the complete sovereignty of God, the oneness of God. Are you following this?
That was the whole world?
The whole world. Why was the whole world? Why does this mean the whole world has in fact recognized the oneness of God? Because Pharaoh was basically the king of the world. Let's look. Let's read the next Zohar on that, and then we'll talk a little more. So, let all people praise Thee. Signifies that when the heathen nations acknowledges the Holy One, His glory is consummated above and below. Okay, above are the angels. Certainly, the angels know God's oneness, but below are people, and all need to acknowledge God's oneness before the oneness of God can become manifest. Alright? I mean, if nobody notices something, then is it manifest? Manifestation is a function of a projection and a reception. Right? So what does it say? When Pharaoh acknowledged Him by saying the Lord is the righteous, and other kings had to, all other kings had to follow suit. Why? Because Pharaoh is the king of the world, of that of the world at that time. Right? In other words, imagine, even though it's not completely true, but if people think, America is a superpower, and it's the one and only superpower of the world, so America sets the trends in the world. And everybody wants to be like Americans. You know, it's kind of funny. I used to think, and it's a total change of my mind, I used to think that in order to do Jewish education, right, Israelis need to do as Jewish education for Israelis, and Americans should be doing it for Americans. And now I'm starting to think it's actually not true. That probably the ones that would be the most successful in revitalizing Jewish consciousness amongst Israelis will be Americans. Because Israelis love things that are American. Right? They get really excited about that. You know, I mean, it's really exciting for an Israeli to hear, and you know, when I was in the army, I like to say it, you know, that I was learning with, and I am learning with Mr. Kirk Douglas. Wow! He's interested in Judaism? What, Kirk? I mean, he's like one of the models of American society, right? Goldie Hawn is learning about Judaism? Wow! In other words, the interesting thing is that the superpower certainly sets the trend, and everybody really loves it. So, you have to understand that in those days, Egypt was the superpower of the superpowers. And therefore, if the king of Egypt acknowledged the oneness of God, that hit the world times all over the place. Everybody was talking about it. And therefore, essentially, everybody followed suit. Then the dukes of Edom were terrified. Why were they terrified of God, so to speak? Because when they realized that Pharaoh gave up and said, yes, it's not just the Jewish people have a very powerful God, but there's really only one God. Okay? That was magnificent. The Pharaoh was then the overlord of the whole world. Then came Yitro, that great and supreme priest of the whole pagan world, and confessed his faith in the Holy One, saying, now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Then the Holy One was exalted in his glory above and below, and then it was that he gave the Torah and the completeness of his dominion. So what we get from the Zohar are some very new sensitivities towards the giving of Torah at Sinai. It puts the Torah into a universal perspective. Okay? One which I don't think most people would have thought of. Alright? Once I see the Zohar, I say, that whole story of getting out of Egypt and this very fact that Yitro is coming is absolutely critical before we can even get to Sinai. Before we can get to Sinai, the whole world has to be in a moment of receptivity for the oneness of God. It could be that there was a moment which lapsed. It lapsed for the world, it lapsed for the Jews. But there had to be a moment of complete universal receptivity for the manifestation of Torah to happen. Because the manifestation of Torah is essentially a manifestation of God's oneness. That's what we learn from the Zohar. Right? Do you follow this? It's not simply a manifestation of a bunch of laws that happened years ago to a particular people at a particular place. This argues is a much deeper appreciation of what it means of revelation at Sinai. Revelation at Sinai means that there is one king, and therefore one law, right, which all human beings are really obligated in, to the extent that they're obligated in it. I mean, there are certain laws that are applicable to these type of people and those type of people. But nonetheless, there's a sense of a one law and a one lawgiver. Alright? Why is that important? Why is it important to believe in the oneness of God? And so what if there's many gods? Big deal. Why is Judaism the absolute antithesis of idolatry? Alright? It's the absolute antithesis of idolatry. And that's important to understand. Very important to understand. Because that's what the Talmud says. That the whole Torah is essentially a statement against idolatry. And when idolatry is destroyed, Torah is fulfilled. What does that mean? So many people have a very primitive understanding of paganism and idolatry. They think it's a bunch of people walking around with little idols and they're bowing down to these idols and it's so silly and how could they have ever thought to bow down to an idol? Okay? And why is Judaism so against idolaters? You know, like, big deal. Like, let everybody do their own thing. And if you want to have an idol, Michael Jackson, and you're, you know, whatever your idol is, that's your thing, right? Like, what do you care? You know that they actually started a church around Michael Jackson? There was a church that started, and they thought he was the second coming, and they have a little statue of him in their church. He started this church. No, I don't know who started it, but I read an article about it. I don't think it took off. It wasn't a big hit. But anyways, so what is idolatry? Idolatry is the deification of natural forces. That's what idolatry is. Idolatry is a deification of natural forces. If you've seen some of the pictures of their idols, what do their idols look like? Animals. Now isn't that a little strange? I was shocked when I first saw that. I went into the Museum of Natural Science of Israel, which is a very small building. I never even heard of it, but I was looking for something to do with my kids and I found it. So, it's a nice little place. And then there was a little display about idolatry. And I was shocked, like it's a bird, or it's an eagle, or it's a wolf, and they would bow down to these animals? I mean, do they think that the animal is higher than the human being? They are deifying animal energy, and see animal energy as the ideal towards what one should aspire to. Why? It's all part of nature. In other words, it's the deification of the natural world. The natural world is God's. And they saw no unified field theory to the whole thing either. And therefore, their understanding is there's the sun, there's the moon, there's the wind, there's the rain, there's the animals. And these are different gods. Natural forces are different gods which are in conflict with each other. Right? And that was their worldview. Now, scientifically, it's understood, right? That it's not so far to think that one would think that. And so, what's so terrible? They thought the sun was a god, the moon was a god, you know, all these different gods. They were dancing, they would pray to these gods. You know, you go to the rain god, you go to the sun god. But what? So what? So it's simply a theological problem which would be remedied as human consciousness would evolve. No. It has very serious ethical, moral underpinnings. Because what is the underpinning? What is the moral, ethical implication of the deification of nature? Yes?
It rationalizes our behavior as being okay on an animal level.
That's right. It means whatever erupts inside me is okay. Because it's nature. Nature is God. Okay? And if nature is God, anything that's natural is godly and is okay. All right? So that's the point. The point is, in their minds, an animal is on a very high level. Why? Because an animal is just what it is. It doesn't have the identity crises. Gee, I wish I were a dog. You know? But animals are just completely what they are. A cat is a cat, a dog is a dog, a wolf is a wolf. Right? And what rules supreme in the animal world? The survival of the fittest. The rule of the jungle is might makes right. So that would therefore be the position of an idolatrous community. Who is the king? What makes a king a king? Might. If you're the biggest, if you're the strongest, if you're the most powerful, you're the God. Because you are the manifestation of might. Do you follow this? Alright? So on the level of statehood, might makes right is a direct dictation of paganism and idolatry. Because idolatry is the deification of the natural world. And in the natural world, what we see, might makes right. The animals sit around and say, oh, it's not fair. Does a lion think twice before it rips apart whatever he wants? Whatever he wants, he does. Because he is the lion. He has the right to be that lion. Do you follow this? All right? That's why in Judaism, idolatry really rings strong for us. Because it's the antithesis of a civilized society. It is the absolute idealization of the world of the jungle. Jews come and say, we've been created in the image of God. Whoa! That was wild! I mean, that was absolutely ingenious, way before anybody's time. Okay? Because what they were really aspiring to was to be like animals. Right? To be just free, spontaneous, and natural like animals. Okay? What were the forms of idolatry? How would they do idolatry? Orgies was a basic form of idolatrous practice. Right? Now, that would be very hard to encourage people to become religious, right? Real easy. Come join an orgy and serve God with us in our orgies. How are you serving God through orgies? Because you're giving unbridled release to your sexual drives. Okay? Sex is natural. Sex is that animal in me. I want this person. I want to do this. I want to do whatever I do. Animals do it with anybody they want, wherever they want. Right? So can we. That's a very high level. That's the way we serve
the natural forces by being completely natural. Do you follow this? And that is the danger of that world. Okay, another way of idolatry was to defecate on the idol. That was called Baal Peor. They had this idol, which they would literally defecate on the idol. And that was considered to be a form of worship. Now, how could defecation be a form of worship? Because once again, it's saying that my natural being is totally God. And everything I do naturally is fine. I'm not embarrassed about anything. The embarrassment itself is seen as a weakness. That you're embarrassed to be naturally what you are, an animal. Right? Do you hear this? Do animals go to bathrooms and close the door and pull little fragrance things so nobody knows they were there? No. No, animals have no problem. They do it anywhere they want. Okay? Because that's the animal world. So the pagan world wasn't simply people bowing down to rocks and stones and, oh, Jews just don't like that. The pagan world was a total attitude. It was the deification of natural forces, which means, ethically, morally, what you want to do is okay. If you feel like doing it, do it. And don't destroy yourself. Don't damage yourself. Don't undermine yourself. Alright? Are we together? Alright? So from a statehood point of view, the meaning of idolatry is might makes right. And therefore slavery is natural. Right? It makes sense that I should rule over you. If I'm able to rule over you, then I'm meant to rule over you. You follow? Whatever I'm able to do is okay. Alright? In the theological world, it was full of sexual promiscuity. It was just being natural and doing what comes natural. Alright. Now, the Talmud says that the Jewish people never really were idolaters. Whenever you see periods in history where the Jewish people became idolaters, it was only in order to give license to their sexual drives. In other words, if a person has strong sexual drives, so they adopt a theology which will make them feel good. Not that they ever believed in this theology, but because the drives were so strong, they adopted a theology which would enable them the license to do what they felt like doing. Alright? Which is again a proof to this idea that idolatry was really identified with a whole form of a world that operates like a jungle. Alright? A world that operates like a jungle. And that world is a world based on din. Din, which is translated as judgment. What does judgment mean? Judgment is the world of nature. Nature is scientific. And judgment is science. Because judgment means cause and effect. Alright? You get what you deserve. Cause and effect. And that's science. Science is cause and effect. There are rules, there are regulations. Right? The very fact that something is regulated makes it into nature. It's regulated. Nothing unusual is going to happen. Because it's regulated. That's the point of regulations. Alright? So to a certain extent, idolatry is a complete deification of the world of judgment. Right? The world of judgment. The world of science. Right? The world of nature. They're all connected. In fact, there's an interesting hint to this. The word for God's judgment, which is Elohim, alright, gives you what? 86. Hateva, which means the nature, also equals exactly 86. And this is brought down in Kabbalah that there's this relationship. Well, why is that an important relationship? Because the name Elohim is the revelation of God through nature, in nature. The name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is the revelation of God beyond nature. But if your image of God is only Elohim, then basically you have deified nature. And if you deify nature, it means you've deified the world of judgment. Alright? You've deified the world of judgment. What? Because Elohim, we do believe in the world of judgment, but we believe it's connected to the world of compassion.
All right. So now what's all this got to do with everything else? Why is it important to believe that there's one God? What is the ethical, moral implications of a one God which transcends nature? What is the moral, ethical difference? If nature is God, then the way I'm close to God is how? By being natural. And if by being natural is hate is natural, anger is natural, doing what I feel like is natural, I mean, that's what people assume to be natural. Well, so then that's my moral world. Right? That's my moral world. And it would be wrong to do anything else. But if I believe in a one transcendental God, a God whose oneness transcends this multiplicity, what does that imply morally and ethically? Yeah?
Because in nature you have all sorts of rivaling forces that are constantly going against each other, one stronger than the other and conquering the other. But if you believe in one God that's united, then instead of relating to your fellow human being in a rivalrous way where somebody is trying to come out on top and just trying to come out stronger, to connect in a meaningful way.
Excellent. In other words, what Shaul is saying is very important. Because that would mean that the whole notion of war would also be an idolatrous practice. Right? It would be natural to go at war. Right? You see war all the time in jungles. Right? Because you have different forces that are in conflict with each other. They didn't have the Einsteinian notion of a unified field theory, which is already a tremendous manifestation revelation in the world. In their times, these are separate forces in conflict. And that's nature, and that's reality. And to be part of reality, be real, that's what you've got to be. But once you understand, no, there's a one God. There's a one force, which all other forces are accountable to. So then what would be your ideal? Would it be war? No. It would be peace. Because you recognize that peace is real and war is an illusion. Do you hear this? Right. What else is the implications morally, ethically of a one transcendental God in contrast to these natural many forces gods? That's what idolatry would say.
Yeah.
That we are our own gods. Because we're all just acting out our nature. And if you act out your nature, it's okay. Right? And I have no reason to think that any other way unless I have a transcendental God. In other words, if I have a sense that there is a reality that goes beyond the natural world, then that means that I can surpass nature because there is a reality that does surpass nature. Alright? In which all of nature itself is subservient to. That's a whole different philosophy already. If you think there's a one transcendental reality that then all of a sudden you're saying, you know. So for the pagan to try and surpass your nature is crazy. Right? You've got to keep your nature. But for the civilized human being, which Judaism is the foundation of in that in the world nowadays, everyone thinks they're so civilized. But in that day, the Jewish people were the only civilized people. Right? Really, when you understand what it means. Because there's a sense that no, there's a transcendental reality. So you remember I quoted to you, Hitler is the epitome of idolatry. What Hitler did was natural for any idolater. Because what Hitler said in Mein Kampf is, we are barbarians, and we're proud of it. Right? I have come to free mankind from the shackles the Jews have inflicted two wounds upon mankind. Conscience on their soul, and circumcision on their body. I come to free the world from that. The struggle for the domination of the world is only between these two camps, the Jews and the Germans. The rest is deception. What is he talking about? World War II really was paganism against the oneness of God-ism. That's really what it is, and when you get to its spiritual underpinnings, that's really what it's all about. That's all, you know, we're barbarians. And anybody who says to you, no, you could surpass your barbarian nature, is a fool, and is only going to bring sadness in the world. Because people will feel they're expected to transcend themselves, to surpass themselves, when that is ridiculous and certainly unnecessary. All right? But the very foundation of Judaism is that you can surpass yourself, that you must surpass yourself. And when you do that, you discover a transcendental self, right? Which is the oneness of God. And that's what the giving of the Torah is all about at Sinai. It's not like a bunch of laws that came down. It was a manifestation of a one God. And the manifestation of this one transcendental God is, you can transcend yourself. Here are laws that maybe at first glance seem a little difficult, seem a little uncomfortable. You can go beyond yourself. You can say, well, this is not in my nature. Right. This is not the way I do things. You can transcend yourself and come to a place beyond that. You can grow. You can develop. You can become supernatural. That's why when it says in the Torah that God went to all the other nations and said, would you like my Torah? And they said, well, what's in it? God said, well, don't steal. They said, oh, we can't accept that because that's the very foundation of our economic... That's our world. I mean, everybody steals around here. Oh, okay, we can't accept it. Went to another nation. We like my Torah. They said, well, that's in it. I said, well, that, you know, no adultery. Adultery. I said, oh my gosh, we couldn't do that. I mean, that's our favorite pastime. That's what we do here all the time. What are they basically saying? They're saying, if the Torah fits my nature, I'll keep it. But by definition, the Torah shouldn't be fitting your nature. By definition, the Torah should be taking you to transcend your nature and come to a level of godliness, transcendence. Do you follow this? It's only the Jewish people that whatever is in it will do, because we believe that we can transcend our nature, our animal nature. And that's the problem when someone comes to learn Torah, they say, well, I want to see how it fits into my life. Well, then you're not looking for a path of transcendence, a path of true growth. Right? You're looking for a path of stifleness. You're looking for something that will say you're okay. I don't want something that tells me I'm not okay. I want something that says I'm okay. My lifestyle and what I naturally gravitate towards is okay. But Judah says, well, who says what you naturally gravitate towards is okay? Because if it is okay, my gosh, what horrible things people do because they say, well, it's in my nature. I was just doing what comes naturally. All right? And so, what the Zohar just gave us is an absolutely critical appreciation for what's really happening on a deeper level. It's giving us the insight of this historical process. It's not simply a king was overthrown and the Jewish people got out, and then there was this priest who converted, and then after that, the Jewish people got the Torah at Sinai. No, this is really the story of the manifestation of the oneness of God in the universe. Right? And the recognition of that oneness in the evolution of the consciousness of mankind. Because idolatry and paganism had to be broken, at least for a moment, for the full manifestation of God's oneness to be revealed, and the laws that say you can transcend yourself could be manifest. You can transcend your nature. There is a supernature. There is a transcendental oneness that we can aspire to participate in and connect to. And this is what the Zohar enables us to appreciate. I have some questions here. Yes. Yes, Sean.
So if the whole world at that time acknowledges there is one God, and they all realize that, then how come the Torah was only given to the Jews?
All right, let's hold on. We'll have to get there. All right? And part of what the Zohar is going to say is going to relate to that in a second. Yeah, Jeff. Well, he saw the Jews as the source. It's like, you know, a lot of what he did was based on, he was very fond of Nietzsche. And Nietzsche said that there's a plot in the world. You know, I mentioned to you this Nietzsche. Nietzsche said, which is a very paganistic thing to say, so there's two types of people in the world. There's strong people and weak people. Right? The strong people do what they want, when they want, how they want. Right? That's, again, a deification of nature. You do what you want. Whatever you want is God. All right. The weak people, though they're weak, he said, were smart. And they created a plot to make the strong ones feel guilty they're so strong. And that's called the plot of morality. And who are the weak people, Nietzsche said, who brought this horrible plot, and because of them everyone's feeling so guilty doing what they feel like doing, when otherwise everyone could have given unbridled release to all the sexual drives and all their, you know, crazy fantasies and desires for this person's, you know, property. Right? Who's responsible for everyone feeling guilty in the world? It's the Jews. The Jews came up with this plot called morality. Nietzsche said this. Who continued this plot? Who were the torchbearers of the plot? It was the Christians. Alright? And so apparently, Hitler saw the Jews as the source of the problem. If he could wipe out the Jews, then everything else would go with it. But the war was about the Jews. It's called The War Against the Jews. There's a book called The War Against the Jews. It really was. It was a theological war. And the Jews won this war because democracy is winning the world, and the ability to, the belief in civilization and the ability, the belief that one can transcend their nature, right, and be holy, right, is beginning to become more and more acceptable. All right. So what did we just learned the Zohar said that the priest and the king of the other side, what is all this? All right. It gives us an appreciation for the giving of the Torah at Sinai as a universal process of an evolving consciousness. And that what needed to be manifest is the one sovereignty of God in the world. And the Jews couldn't have done it alone, which is very interesting according to Zohar. It's not like the Jews said, oh, goodbye world, we do our thing. But even the world had to, at least momentarily, be in a certain place that was ready before the Jews could even get it. Alright? Let's go to the next piece. He sent redemption to his people, namely when he redeemed Israel from Egypt. He has commanded his covenant forever. Now the word in Hebrew forever is olam, which can also mean, what is an olam? A world. So therefore it can also be translated as he commanded his covenant for the world. That is when Yitro came and the Holy One received him into his covenant, brought him near to himself, that he might worship him. Since then, all proselytes have been brought to sit rest under the wings of the Shekhinah, and thereby holy and awful, not awful, it's terrible, but awful meaning full of awe, is his name. For the holy name is hallowed then when the other side is subdued and broken, as in the case of Jethro. First of all, we see consistency thematically, that the other side, which is the side that promotes absolute separateness and multiplicity of the universe, a world of absolute, you know, science, and we're talking about a very primitive science, not even a unified field theory science, okay? But what does this Zohar also tell us? That a certain precedent had to be set for the possibility of conversion before the Torah was given. Do you know this? Now why is that an important point? Had I not seen that, what would I have thought? See, once again, it puts the giving of the Torah at Sinai into a much more universal tone. That before we could get it, the possibility for other people to get it needed to be put in place. Alright? And that's all essential in terms of really defining the meaning of the Torah at Sinai. Alright? Was the Torah at Sinai a private affair between the Jews and God? Did the Jews elope with God and say, to hell with the world, we're going on? This is something we talked about before. Is chosenness a statement of rejection of the world? Definitely not. In Judaism, God chose the Jewish people, and that was an affirmation of his commitment to the world. I'm going to bring about redemption for the whole world through this people. Okay? Through this people.
He asked for the other people too, and they said no.
And they said no. Well, that's what the Midrash says.
He asked them when they
it was not a question of asking them, do they believe in one God? There was a moment where consciousness was receptive.
Just a moment, so.
Well, it was enough, a couple of days, I don't know. You know, paganism certainly went way after the giving of Torah at Sinai. But the Zohar is saying that the reason why we needed to see the downfall of the king Pharaoh and Yitro converting is because all that was essential to really be receptive for the Torah. And obviously the Zohar is basing itself on an assumption that there must be universal readiness in some form, right? Before the Torah could be given, and that's essential in order for us to appreciate the universal quality of what it means to be a Jew. Alright? Because without that, you're really left with very, very sad understandings. So now, here comes a beautiful piece that I brought in. It's a bit of a tangent, but it's brought right here, and I don't really believe it's so much of a tangent when you really look at it carefully. Was Yitro the only one who heard all that God had done? Remember, the verse says that Yitro heard. And our question was, well, why did Yitro hear and nobody else heard? And how did he hear and nobody else heard? So what was our answer? That not that he listened in the terms of, not physically he heard, right? It wasn't a physical hearing. Everybody heard, right? Was Yitro the only one who heard all that God had done? Does it not say peoples heard, they were afraid? It says in Exodus that everybody heard about what was going on, right? So what's the difference in Yitro and everybody else? Indeed, the whole world did hear, yet Yitro alone renounced idolatry and accepted the Holy One to worship Him. In other words, the Zohar is telling us, what does it mean to hear? What does v'yishma mean? What does shma mean? What? It means a kind of responsive hearing, right? I mean, two people are watching television and one person hears about the news in Afghanistan. And one says, oh, look, you know, they're killing people over Gaza. And the other one responds, I've got to do something about this. Right? Were they both hearing? Right? Maybe physically it went into both of their ears, but one went into the one ear and out the other, and the other one hit his soul and it responded. That's what it means, Shema Yisrael. When we say Shema Yisrael, it means hear it and respond and do something about it. It's an active hearing. All right. And that's what he did. He renounced idolatry and accepted the Holy One to worship Him. Said Rabbi Abba, we have frequently affirmed that whatever the Holy One has made, whether it be above or below, has a purpose. This Zohar is one of the most essential beliefs in Judaism. And that's why it comes here, and I think it's very important that we do this. He is truth and His work is truth. And therefore, no phenomena in the world is to be spurned as of no account, since everything is formed according to a divine pattern, and therefore is of some necessity. This is the most fundamental principle in Judaism. Everything, if it exists, has a purpose, has a reason. Because God is one, and everything in some way is harmoniously connected and interconnected, and nothing is trashed in our worldview. Everything is ultimately transformed. Yes? For sure. Somehow, it fits into an ultimate plan. Whether we're able to appreciate ultimate plan, who knows? We're not. Alright? We will, according to Judaism, that's the world to come. When we go to the world to come, we will have a higher perspective where everything that seemed to us as horrible, we will see how it fit into the process of our lives. Well, there are certain things that are arbitrary, and yet those are also somehow, in a deeper way, part of a plan, too.
And because it's God's plan, God wants it this way.
This is too deep right now, because I know where you're driving at, and we're going to end up in the dead end, right? Because it's true and it's not true. We have to understand what that means, okay? In the long run, ultimately, yes. But in the short run, sometimes no. And that's not for now. So it goes like this. Why does he bring this up over here? So he says, everything is of some necessity. If it exists, then it must play some necessary role. Once, for example, Rabbi Elazar was walking along accompanied by Rav Yecheskiah, when they came across a snake. Rabbi Yecheskiah was about to kill it, but Rabbi Elazar said, nay, leave it alone, do not kill it. Amazing idea. Not even a snake. You know, it is a Hasidic tradition that you shouldn't even kill a fly. And you just don't like it. Not doing you any harm, so leave it alone. Right? You should really try and not kill. If you got a spider in your house, just try and not kill it. You can get it out of your house without killing it. It's better, right? Why kill it? He says, but is it not a noxious creature which kills people? I mean, this is not a fly. We're talking about a snake. To which Rabbi Eliezer replied, it is written, does the serpent bite without enchantment? Whispering is literally what it says. A serpent only bites because of whispering. So, one would think that means what? The hissing noise that a snake makes before it's about to bite. But the Zohar says, no, it's not the whispering of the snake, but God whispers into the ear, so to speak, of the snake. The snake doesn't bite anybody that it hasn't been guided to bite. Right? Why? To which Rabbi Eller said, "Does it not? Is it not written? Does the serpent bite without enchantment? The serpent does not bite unless it be whispered to from above and commanded to kill someone so as to prevent that person from committing some evil. That itself is a really fascinating Zohar because it gives us a different understanding. I think most people would have thought, you know, because that person has committed an evil, right? But the Zohar surprises us and says that the snake may bite somebody as an act of mercy, not as an act of judgment. What is the mercy?
Prevent the person from doing something evil.
Right. In other words, sometimes, why do bad things happen to good people? So those good people don't end up doing bad things. Right? That in fact, sometimes, it's to save you spiritually. So that you do not damage yourself in this world, and you're brought to the next world quickly. So you save some of the possibilities, or God knew that you were going to do this, so I better get you out of this world before you do such a horrible sin, and it'd be even more devastating. It's an interesting piece of Zohar. It's not saying that's the only reason that something could happen, but it's interesting that that's the reason it brings. But it's ultimately an act of compassion, because the truth is Judaism believes that all judgment is an act of compassion. All judgment is an act of compassion. Right? To get what you deserve is an act of compassion. You need to get that. Because you need to grow, you need to learn, you need to change. It's an act of compassion. Right? It was like somebody told me a story, I mentioned last program, how they had a son who was in a drug rehabilitation center. And he escaped from the center and was coming home. And before he got home, the center called the mother and said, "Don't you dare let him into your house. No matter what he says, don't let him in your house. Because that would be the worst thing you could ever do to this guy. If you love your son, tell him to go away and go back to the center." And she said that was one of the hardest things she ever did in her entire life. Because that son came banging on the door, "Mom, let me in, let me in." She said, I can't. She said, "Mom, you hate me. Why are you punishing me?" And she said, "I love you. And that's why I have to do it." Right? And so sometimes we don't know how harsh a judgment could look. In his eyes, my gosh, it must have been the harshest thing. His mother betrayed him. And yet, later on, I'm sure he realized that it was really his mother's incredible compassion. It was actually an even greater compassion to say no than it would have been if she would have said yes and let him in. And so over here we get a fascinating piece over here that the serpent doesn't bite unless it's being whispered to bite, and it may be whispered to bite to prevent someone from committing an evil. Thus the very poison is used by the Holy One in order to perform some miracle. This is a miracle that you died. Thank God, what a miracle I died. It's amazing Zohar that gives you some pause to think about what happens in our lives, and maybe it would have been worse, right? Maybe this is the best option, even though maybe it's hard for us to appreciate it now. Is it in truth? It is in truth. All is in His hands. It is all according to His plan. And if it had no purpose, He would not have created it. And therefore, if it's there, has a purpose. And if it is wrong to despise anything in this world, don't despise a snake. Right? And I have to understand the Zohar is talking a double language. Because everybody knows that what the snake really means to us. Whenever we say the word snake, who do we think of? We think about the serpent in the garden, who is the manifestation of the evil force in the world. Right? And that's what it is. It's out to get you, this evil force. And so immediately when we read this Zohar, it's not just talking about some physical thing about it. They just saw a snake. But he was talking about the snake. Right? And now even the snake, the poisonous snake of the evil tempter, you don't even have the right to despise. Right? You can fight it, you have to fight it. But you're not allowed to really despise it. Because in some way, it's also serving a holy purpose. Alright? It's also serving a holy purpose. And if it is wrong to despise anything in this world, how much more sinful must it be to think lightly of any act, word or act of the Holy One, blessed be He. Alright? It's an amazing piece. It's an amazing piece because it means that Jews don't despise anybody or anything in the world. Because they realize that all is really one. right? Even though, on the other hand, they know they have to fight. But in a deep, deep sense, they don't despise. Let's go on. And God saw everything that He made, and behold, it was very good. Everything He made was very good. All right? The living God purposed to give us light and to care for us in His providence. And in His creation, all is united. Above and below, right and left, the angel of life, the angel of death, all are part of His plan, and it is very good. When you see it all in a oneness, these opposites are united. Right? The immanence and the transcendence, which is the above and the below. The compassion and the judgment, which is the right and the left. They're all really one. The angel of life and the angel of death, they're all really one. They're opposite sides of one coin. Okay? They're opposites, and yet they're one. And they all serve a plan. They all serve a oneness. And it's all part of the same mystic doctrine apprehended by those who contemplate the mystery of wisdom. Now, why did he bring this whole thing in here all of a sudden? Because it was Yitro who gave Moses sound advice concerning the administration of justice. And in this is contained an allusion to confessing the Holy One, namely in his awareness that God's, that judgment is God's and belongs not to the other side. And that law and right were given to Israel and not to any of the heathen nations. As it is written, He shows His word unto Jacob, His statutes and His judgments unto Israel. He hath not dealt so with any other nation. As for His judgments, they have not known them. No, so one must beware of despising anyone, since the words of an ordinary person may be of great consequence. As it says of Moses, that he hearkened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Now, what happens in this story? Yitro comes and converts. We're going to do it inside soon. And he notices that Moses is convening court all day long. People are coming to him with all kinds of Torah questions. Right? And his father-in-law says, you can't do this, you can't handle this by yourself. And he gives them a whole plan for a judicial system. Right? And Moses listens to him. Why is the Zohar brought here? It says, Yitro heard, right? And he came, he renounced idolatry, and all of a sudden we realize that Yitro is responsible for the judicial system of Judaism. And you say to yourself, wow, that's quite a remarkable leap. First, he was the greatest idolater in the world, the epitome of paganism. He converts, and not only does he convert to Judaism, but he contributes something of incredible significance to the very structure of our judicial system. Right? And so what do we learn from this? That everything contributes in the long run. Right? And nothing should be despised. And even someone like a Yitro, who may have led a very horrible life from a Jewish perspective, he does tshuva, could people really eradicate the bad feelings towards him because of his past? The answer is absolutely. Absolutely. Not only that, but they were happy to hear his advice and reacted and responded according to his advice. Now, of course, the truth is they obviously had to ask God to get the confirmation. The interesting thing is, why did God leave this very important revelation of how a judicial system should be set up? Why did God leave it to this past idolatry Yitro? Right? It's to teach us how everybody contributes to God's plan and God's revelation in some way. Right? In some way. And therefore no one is to be despised. Now, the Zohar says something else here which I think is very important to talk about. You see, the idolater idolizes din. What do we say din is? Judgment. But judgment is science. Cause and effect. Forces. There's no such thing as compassion for an idolater. Because compassion is not natural. It's not really natural to have compassion over a person. Because what is compassion? What does compassion really mean? Judgment means you get what you deserve. Okay? What does compassion mean? It means you get it even if you don't deserve it. Right? What does kindness mean? What does kindness mean? Kindness is when I do something for a person, right? Even though there's no reason that I should do this for this person, I don't owe it to them. Alright? In other words, if I hit your car and I pay for it, was that an act of kindness? Yeah, that's an act of justice. I hit it, I should pay for it. But if I one day walk up to your car and start washing it for no reason, is that compassion or is that kindness? That's kindness. I do something which there's no reason for me to do this for you. You know, I don't owe this to you, but I do it anyways. Now what happens if you treated me really lousy yesterday, and the next day what I do is I go up and I wash your car? Is that an act of kindness or an act of compassion? That's an act of compassion, because you don't deserve me to do this. In other words, compassion transcends judgment. From the standpoint of judgment, I shouldn't do it. Kindness has nothing saying, don't do it. And there's nothing saying, do it. So kindness itself is a pretty nice thing to do. But compassion is absolutely irrational. Compassion is absolutely unscientific. Because compassion says that even though you don't deserve it, I'm going to do it for you. That's compassion. Do you follow this? If someone goes into a doctor and he examines them, sees that his liver is really shot, says, "Mr. So-and-so, your liver is really shot, you've got about 5 years to live." Right? Well, Mr. So-and-so starts to plead with him, says, "I'm sorry. Please, I'm sorry. Give me another chance. I promise I won't drink anymore. I'm very sorry." What does the doctor say? He said, "Well, don't say sorry to me. There's nothing I can do for you, mister. I mean, that's science. If you drink too much, your liver goes, and that's it. Huh? That's all I can say. I can't help you." He said, "Oh, but I'm sorry. I'm really sorry about it, and I won't do it again." He said, "I appreciate that. But I can't help you, because scientifically, if you do this, you get that." Right? So, an absolute scientist would walk out in utter desperation. But a person of belief would say, "Well, that's very nice that that doctor said it, but I believe that a miracle could happen." You follow? Miracles belong to the world of compassion. Right? An idolater could never believe in a miracle, because that means that nature has been transcended. That means there's a force that transcends nature, which even Nietzsche would have to answer to. Do you follow this? Am I making sense here? That's compassion. That's compassion. Alright. Now, once again, the idolatrous paganist world lives in a world of judgment. Lives in a world of science. Alright? Lives in a world of nature. And therefore, they're real experts in judgment and justice. Right? They just know all that. You know, one of the idolatrous worlds was Sodom, which was destroyed. In Sodom, there was a law. It was absolutely forbidden to be hospitable. It was capital punishment. Because what happens, if you remember, Lot brought in these angels who he thought were strangers into his house to be hospitable, and the whole community attacked him. Right? How can you do this? In Sodom, the law is nobody does anything nice to anybody else. Because that's not justice. Right? Person gets what they deserve. What you earn, you get. Nobody should give you free handouts. Makes sense, right? From an idolatrous world point of view, you're destroying our world by being kind or compassionate. Alright? Judaism is the antithesis of paganism. Yitro, he's very well trained in the rules of justice. But he doesn't know compassion. So what is this Zohar hinting to when it says all of a sudden, let's go back to it now that I just gave you that old little song and dance. Let's go to this paragraph over here, just before 68. It was Yitro who gave Moses sound advice concerning the administration of justice. It makes sense because they're experts at justice. They're expert at science. They're expert in organization, rules, regulations. They're great at that. Right? They're great administrators. Right? You do it this way, you get that. You do it that way, you get this. Great. And in this is contained the allusion to his confessing the holy name. It is awareness that judgment is God's. Right? But how is he confessing God's name by giving Moses advice? Mystically, Yitro, who represents the pagan world, is giving Moses advice, which represents the Jewish world. Alright? The pagan world is justice. The Jewish world is based on compassion. So the expert of judgment gives the expert of compassion some advice about judgment. So then you say to yourself, well, wait a second, if this guy is such an expert in judgment, then who should have God given his law to? One's a really expert in judgments. Right? Who are found believers of the world of science, the world of judgment, the world of laws.
Assuming that's all there, though.
So let's look. So he says, and this is contained in allusion to his confessing the holy name in his awareness that judgment is God's. By him giving over judicial advice to Moses is as if he confessing that judgment must be in the hands of God. What does that mean? And belongs not to the other side. Okay, and what do we say the other side means? The force that says everything is separated. And that law and right were given to Israel and not to any of the heathen nations. As is written, he shows his words unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgments unto Israel. He has not dealt so with any other nation. Why did God give Israel the law and not to any other nation?
Because we
have
compassion.
What? Because we have compassion. Because we understand that it's all part of the world of compassion. In other words, who should you give the law to? One who is so adept in law will become dogmatic. Right? They'll deify the law. But if you give the law over to one whose essential connection is compassion, then the law will never become idolatrous and dogmatic and scientific. Do you hear this? Very important piece over here. So one must beware of despising anyone. So it's a very important idea, and it relates to what someone asked the question, well, wait a second, if the whole world needed to be in a state of there needed to be a universal consciousness to accept the oneness of God, why did then God give the law to the Jewish people? Because only they could be entrusted with the law, because if the law were given to any other people, they'd make it into a very harsh, dogmatic way of life. But Jewish people did not. Right? Now, I'm not saying you won't find some Jewish people who did, okay? But that's the amazing thing. That's the amazing thing. When God gives the Torah to the Jewish people at Sinai, what he's doing is he's entrusting them with the law which will ultimately be meaningful for the whole world. Right? Who should be responsible for the law in the world? The law of God in the world? Only the one who understands that the world is based on compassion and not justice. And the justice is subordinate to compassion. Because otherwise you're in big trouble. Otherwise an idolater could go really to town with the law and become so dogmatic and so harsh, so rigid. And yet that was the amazing thing about the Torah as it came down to us. I'm feeling not everybody's here with me over here. Did you get the point? Right? Yeah.
Just back to, I think what you were saying was so crucial about, can you reiterate what you were saying, how we would spread, or we will spread, the law unto other nations?
Well, we're not going to do that right now. But that's an important point. The Jews are called a light unto the nations. The Jews are called a mamlechet kohanim, a priestly kingdom. All right? We have a responsibility to the world. We're going to explore that when we get to the verse that really deals with that. I'm just bringing this in because it has to do with Yitro. All right? And the relation between the pagan and the Jew, which is the relation between a deification of the world of justice, which is the world of science, which is a world that knows no such thing as compassion. Okay? Science isn't compassionate. If X is X, then it's not Y. If cause is cause, then effect is effect, then there's nothing I can do about it. That's science. That's a world of science. And yet compassion says, nonetheless, it can still happen. And so the world of compassion is a world of miracles. And it's the world of the oneness of God. Because since God is one, right, He doesn't have to play by the rules, because He's not subordinate to the rules. He transcends the rules. And He can break into the rules at any point that He wants to. Right? And to understand that is critical to receive the Torah. I have to understand what I'm receiving the Torah in. I'm receiving the Torah in a state whereby the world of science, or the absolute control of the world of science, was denied, so that there could be a moment for the revelation of compassion.
Why did God even ask the other nations if they wanted the Torah and it came and wasn't
going to be? Well, the question is that Midrash being literal or not? Okay, is that Midrash telling us a point about what it means for us to receive the Torah? Right, so that's, you know, that's questionable whether it's literal, and do we have any records that nations said they once were given this offer, right? But it's important to understand that the Jewish people realize that everyone in the world has something to contribute ultimately to the revelation of Torah, right? But who is responsible to Torah? And who is responsible for the manifestation of God's oneness in the world? That's the Jewish people's role in the world. So let's read on. Rabbi Elazar continued. It is written, therefore, I shall praise thee, O Lord, among the nations, and sing praises unto your name. We have a very important verse. This is a very universal verse. King David is saying that we should sing the praises of God to the nations. Now, you know, a lot of Jews are under the impression that Judaism is very particularistic, and we're into ourselves, and we're very isolated and insulated, and, you know, and, you know, we have nothing to do with the world. It's a famous statement in the Fiddler on the Roof, right? Where they come up to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, is there a blessing for the Tsar? He says, yes, may God keep the Tsar far away from us. Okay? That's, you know, typical sense that, yes, the Jews separate from the world, and, but does that mean the Jews turn their back on the world? Does that mean that the Jews don't care about the world? Does that mean that the world isn't part of the Jewish experience? No, the verse says that we have to sing the song of praises of God to the whole world. That's our ideal, is to tell the world about this. Right? But of course, you can't tell it to the world until you told it to yourself. Right? And we, unfortunately, haven't even gotten our message straight. David said this under the prompting of the Holy Spirit, when he saw that the glory of the Holy One is not exalted and honored in the world, as it should be, unless other nations also contribute. That's essential. The name of God, the revelation of God, can't happen unless the other nations contribute. It is true that the Holy One is glorified for Israel's sake alone. It's true, we do say that through Israel God is glorified. But while Israel are the foundation of divine light, from out of which issues forth light for the whole world, yet when heathens, nations come to accept the glory of the Holy One and to worship Him, then the foundation of light is strengthened, and all its rays are unified, and then the Holy One reigns above and below. The Jewish people are a conduit for the light of God into the world. That's how we understand it. Right? That's how we understand it. And before the Jewish people could get the Torah, the whole world had to be at a certain level of readiness also. Right? Readiness also. The Jewish people to the world are like a teacher to a student. But there's no such thing as a teacher without a student. There's no such thing as a student without a teacher. We're different, but we're one. Okay? If the teacher becomes a student and the student becomes a teacher, that's not a good scene, right? We're confusing our roles. But yes, the light is given to the Jewish people, but the Jewish people can't accept it unless they have a world that is willing to accept it from them. Because otherwise, what's the point of us being teachers if there's no students? Are you following this?
Can you repeat that?
Yes. The relation between the Jewish people and the world is like the relation between a student and a teacher. Alright? Student and a teacher. You can't have a teacher without a student, right? Because if there's no students, there's no teacher. You can't have a teacher without a student, you can't have a student without a teacher. Different, but one. Alright? In the very definition of a teacher are students, and in the very definition of students is teacher. It's part of their definition. Alright? Before the Jewish people could receive the Torah, the whole world needed to be in a receptive mode. Because we're not getting the Torah for ourselves. Right? We're getting the Torah in order to be a conduit of that light to the whole world. Right? To the extent that it's applicable to the whole world. In other words, when I'm teaching Torah, right, I get more Torah than when I'm just learning it for myself. I just know it. It's always like that. It's always like that. Because God's not going to give me a Torah unless I'm going to give it to somebody. Because I have nobody to give it to, then I don't need it either. And so to the extent that the student is receptive, the teacher is going to be given even more insights. Right? Because it's a whole revelation that's happening for all of us. It's just a question of different roles. How does it filter down? How does it get in there? Alright? And so, once again, the Zohar returns back to this very universal theme that it obviously is emphasizing this entire way. That before the Jewish people could get the Torah, the world had to be ready. Let's read on. This is exactly what happened. When Jethro, the high priest of paganism, was converted to the worship of the true God of Israel, the whole world, hearing of the mighty works of the Holy One and seeing that the great sage Yitro had been drawn to the worship of God of Israel, gave up their idols, realizing their impotence, and in this way the glory of the Holy One of God was exalted on all sides. For this reason, the narrative concerning Yitro has been preserved in the Torah with Yitro's name at the head. So remember, we asked the question, why is it that such a especially Jewish chapter, which is the giving of the Torah at Sinai, has the title name of a non-Jew who converted? Right? Because it really sets the appreciation for the universality of this experience. Right? That even though it was a particular experience for the Jew, it could only happen within the context of a universal readiness. Because it has an ultimate universal meaning. And until that ultimate universal meaning was established and clarified, even though not necessarily completely fulfilled yet, until that was set in place, we couldn't be at Sinai. When Rabbi Shimon went on to expound in connection with this theme, the words of the prophet, and many people shall go and say, come ye and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. A time will come, he said, when the heathen nations will wear their feet out to go and be brought under the wing of the Shekhinah. Let us go up, they will say, since all paganism is a descent into the world of nature, but cleaving to the Holy One is an ascent. And that's our ultimate view. Our ultimate view is not that everyone will become Jewish, but that everyone will tap into the Holy Spirit. Right? Into the Holy Spirit. And Judaism claims that it has the way that one does it for Jews and not Jews. But that doesn't mean that it's the same way for Jews and not Jews. But that we've been handed this responsibility, the secret of the possibility for the Holy Spirit, so to speak, that connecting with God in the world. And that is our role. That is our job. Alright? And until we appreciate that, we're not going to do it. And the last thing. Of course, everyone knows that a convert is called a ger. And when you think about it, it should strike you as a little odd. It would strike you as something non-accepting. Because a ger means a stranger. And yet the whole point is to show you, we've been talking about how open the Jewish people are to converts. And open to the world to share the reality of God to whatever extent they're ready to commit. So why then is a convert called a ger, which means a stranger? Look what the Zohar says. However, although he is joined to this holy supernal sphere, yet he is called a ger, a sojourner, a person living out of his country because he has left his own people and his kin and taken up his abode in a new place. Why is a convert called a ger, which means a stranger? When it seems like an insult, it's really a compliment. What's the compliment? Yes? Exactly. That you had the courage to become a stranger to your own people. And therefore we're very sensitive to you. And we have such admiration. Because that's what the Jewish people are all about. The Jewish people have always been strangers. Right? The first Jew is called an Ivri. Where does the word Ivri come from? The word Ivri comes from? Across the river. Right? To be a Jew means the willingness to be a stranger in this world. Because you're doing things that nobody else is doing. And so they look at you as a stranger. And the willingness to be a stranger is a tremendous statement of strength. You're not a conformist. You're willing to be a stranger in order to get to know God. And therefore, to call a convert a ger is actually a compliment. That we compliment you that you were willing and able to become a stranger to your own people. Right? And the Jewish people are also called gerim. We're also called strangers. Because we've been strangers to this world, right, for a very long time. So what do we basically accomplish? In a lot of words. What the Zohar provided us was with a thematic context. The Midrashim didn't give us that so much, but this Zohar did. It gave us a sense of the thematic development of how all these stories are working and how really it's all a theme of an evolving consciousness towards the revelation and acknowledgement of God's oneness and supreme sovereignty. And that's the theme of Judaism. Right? The entire Torah is really that. This Zohar is showing us within that minimal segment. But the entire Torah is all about the evolution of mankind towards the ability to connect with God, the Shekhinah, and to become one, and to recognize that oneness. That's the theme of the entire Torah. And this is just the beginning. We haven't even gotten it yet. I wanted to work on the preparatory stages. What we need to understand before we get the Torah. If we don't understand it, we're going to be given the Torah, but we're going to get the wrong thing.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.